one.
Next one's ready.
Next item on our agenda, Falconry Guidebook. Jim, if you'll come and give us that presentation.
Falconry or Falconry?
Yes.
I say Falconry typically, but Falconry is okay. If I applied my southern accent more than you probably hear right now, probably something like Falconry. Either one works. Whatever suits you, just tickles me plumb to death. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, members of the RAC, DWR staff, and what audience we have left. Today we're presenting the, our recommendations on the five-year review of Rule R657-20, the rule that regulates Falconry in Utah. There should be a copy of the rule in your packets, as well as two tables for the guidebook. And those are the items I'll be focusing on in part of our presentation. I have three main things I want to cover with you. Just a brief look at the practice of falconry in Utah. For some of you that may not have looked into falconry before. And then some of the actions that have taken place since our last review with this rule. And then our summary of the recommendations that we're presenting for the current five-year review. We have defined falconry to focus on hunting. At one time in our rule, that was not the case. As coordinator for the program, I'm trying to move us away from individuals that just want to keep birds as pets, more or less, and focus on hunting, which is the real core and the nature of the sport, and keep that focus. But there's also language in our rule that includes training, care of the birds, transport of the birds, but everything associated with a hunting experience and a hunting opportunity. We have about 190 licensed falconers in Utah. There's a breakdown there for you by region. The northern part of the state has most of them. And in fact, Davis, Salt Lake, and Wasatch counties together account for about 85% of that total. There are three classes of falconer, apprentice, general, and master, and the numbers for each class that we have right now are there in the slide. The difference is based on age and experience, and I'll touch on that a little bit more as we go along. The apprentice class is the entry level. It's the most restrictive class in terms of numbers of birds that individuals can keep and fly. And then the general class is a little more liberal. Master class is the least restricted, and the years there in between each class, an apprentice must serve 2 years under a sponsor before he can qualify for an upgrade to general. And then a general class doesn't need a sponsor, but he or she must show 5 years experience before they can qualify for upgrade to the master class. Since our last review, the major change has been that the Fish and Wildlife Service no longer regulates falconry directly as they did before 2000 and, well, officially for us before 2010. In 2008, the service made a rule change on their end that they would no longer regulate falconry for the states, and particularly for us in Utah. They did set some new standards, and every state was required to comply with those standards. And we were able to modify our rule, and it was approved by the RAC and the board in January 2010, and it was approved by the service. And so we're now under this new rule where we regulate the sport ourselves, and we do not need federal permits. Before that, an individual had to have one of our CORs, as well as a federal permit, in order to practice the sport in the state. A little bit further since then, we're now solely regulated by the state. There's a limited take of raptors. I'll touch on that in just a minute, by class. And falconers can report their activities online now, whereas before they couldn't. The requirement to ban these birds was relaxed by the service, although an individual can choose to have a microchip implanted into the birds for tracking. The facilities requirements were relaxed. The main change there was The Fish and Wildlife Service allows individuals to keep these birds in their home. If you wanted to take a room in your house and turn it into a room to keep these birds, you can do that. But that house or that facility, that dwelling, that residence, is subject to inspection under our guidelines for inspection that our COs perform as a regular part of these activities anyway. We added some new definitions, and we now offer both an extended year COR for apprentice class of 3 years and general and master class of 5 years. So those are some of the things that have changed since the 2006 review. For the current review, we have some editorial cleanup we need to do, and the page numbers and sections in the rule are referenced there for you. One of the big things was the service reduced the minimum age from 14 to 12. That was already done under a separate rule and code, and so now our recommendation is that we also reflect that in the Falconry rule as well, to just be in compliance with other parts of our code. There were some changes in nomenclature, the taxonomic side of things. That was done by the American Ornithologist Union, so we'd like to be in compliance with that. And then some clarification on take and possession, which I'll get to here more in just a minute. And the apprentice class, this gets more to the guidebook, touching a little bit on the guidebook changes as well. Apprentice class are not allowed to possess the young birds that are taken out of their nests. The term for that is IS or ISs, or nestlings. They also cannot possess an imprinted raptor, a raptor that's imprinted on humans as either a sibling or a parent, and they cannot possess hybrids of North American species. They also cannot possess wild-caught species that are listed in a rule of birds that are listed by the service as species of national concern. And those are the restrictions of the apprentice class. Other than golden eagle, as listed on the list there, on the left side of the slide, golden eagle is the only raptor that's different, and you'll see why in just a minute. All the other raptors would be available for all classes, but the age of the raptor would be the restriction by class, as I mentioned, for the apprentices. General class cannot possess eagles. Goldens or bald eagles, either one, they cannot possess an eagle, but all of the other species listed there they can use and fly in the sport. And master class falconers, though, can possess golden eagles, but not bald eagles. So I didn't even put bald eagles on the list because really no one can use bald eagles for falconry in Utah or in any other state until the service perhaps changes that one day. Additional clarifications on replacement of wild caught raptors. There was some, a little bit of cleanup in the wording in our rule. They can replace up to two birds a year if one escapes or dies or something happens. And so we've clarified that with our current recommendation. Only general and master class falconers that are doing breeding and doing captive breeding and have a separate COR for captive breeding can either sell or barter the birds. On our facilities inspections, now request that an individual call, or with our recommendation is that an individual call into the region where they reside, schedule an inspection with a CO from that region. And that's our procedure, our new procedure with this recommendation for doing the inspections. And then the guidebook tables, I mentioned you have in your packet already. So golden eagles, they can only be possessed by master class falconers, and they cannot possess the nestlings. So they have to go out and either catch a wild bird that's already on the wing, or trade with someone else for a bird, or get one from perhaps a captive breeding project, but they can't take the wild birds. With Harris's hawks are non-native to Utah, but they're a very popular bird with the falconers, but they can't obtain individuals from captive bred stock or from other states that allow that or other licensed falconers. Likewise, with rough legs, they're also non-native, but they have the same options on picking up one if they want to try to fly a rough-legged hawk. Ruginous hawk is a native, but it's also on our sensitive species list and in our wildlife action plan. So we're only allowing the use of captive bred birds or ones that they obtain from other falconers or from outside of Utah. Deer falcon, also a non-native, but the same sources are available for them. But we do allow a wild-caught bird to be taken in the winter. And those are birds that are already on the wing, already fully fledged and able to fly. And we occasionally have them show up in the northern part of the state. in Peregrine Falcon, excuse me, they may, an apprentice class may only possess non-imprint, non-hybrid Peregrines that are obtained from captive stock or from licensed falconers or from other states. We still have some restrictions on Peregrines to protect our nesting population. We do have a draw for the nestlings, but that's only for a general class or above falconers, not for the apprentices. So in summary, we have the editorial corrections and clarifications that we've touched on. Lowering the minimum age from 14 to 12, the taxonomic wording and nomenclature that would reflect the changes that I mentioned. And then on take and possession, replacement, the sale and barter, and then facilities inspections, so all of those are part of the recommendation. And then the falconry guidebook tables that are there in your packet. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions from the board?
Hey. So, how many active people do we have in this program?
190.
190 total?
Yes, sir.
That's statewide?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. I can, if you want to see the region, I can bring
this. So, what kind of dollars does that bring in?
Just on the license sales?
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy. We've asked fiscal for that. It's a little difficult to track because it all shows up as part of our restricted dollars, and it's not tracked necessarily by a falconry license versus some others. But it depends on the class.
We would get money from the COR fee.
The COR fee.
And the capture permits.
And the capture permits, yeah. If they take a wild bird, they have to apply for a capture permit and be issued a capture permit. We charge for that. And then the COR fee whenever those come for renewal. We're still in a staggered renewal cycle because of the requirement to have the Fish and Wildlife Service permit. We didn't always match with their schedule on when their permits expired. Now we don't have that, but we still have some CORs that reflect when we were under that system. So in other words, they don't all come review for renewal on December 31st. We're trying to kind of work towards that. But it's going to take us a few years to get there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is there any matching dollars from the federal government on this program?
No, sir.
No.
Sorry.
Small game licenses, we get money back.
Right. Well, we need to get a portion of that, I guess. Okay. And they do still have to have up a game or small game license for whatever they want to try to pursue. But we don't receive any federal cost share for that program.
Any other questions?
Well done.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Yes, sir.
Questions from the RAC? Questions from the RAC?
I got one more question. So what does it cost to run this program for that 190?
I can tell you my budget for this year was less than $20,000. And
okay, so you do some other, and you have some other people that carry on with other parts or helping with other staff or whatever.
Well, I have two sets of brains, and they're extra brains, and they're right there. So, but we do have one other individual that on the administrative side helps us with things, and so part of their salary is paid out of that as well. But that's taken off before I received my base funds for the program. So more of the administrative costs for COVID. Did that answer it? Okay.
Jim, do you want me to?
Oh, yeah, Greg. Sure.
Greg Sheehan, Administrative Services. The revenue that brings in is about $7,000 to $8,000 a year when they get in permitting fees. Because those are state collections, those can be matched with the federal funds you were talking about, Jake, the PR dollars. I can't recall we're putting any PR dollars into these falconry programs, but legally it could be, but I don't think that's really where we direct those. So we do kind of put that money back into the Jim's program, and he's got some other funding sources as well, some general funds and things that help pay for part of the cost of those day-to-day
. Thanks, Greg.
Any comments from anybody in the audience? go to the rec? Starting over with you, Robert, this time.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Our motion from the Northern Region Regional Advisory Council was to accept the Falconry Guidebook and Rule as presented and passed unanimously.
Lloyd?
Northeastern Rec to accept as presented and passed unanimously.
Same with the Central Rec, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Derek.
Same with the Southeast Rec. Same with South.
Okay, all five racks unanimously approved the DWR presentation. Board discussion and a motion.
Chair, I make a motion that we approve the Falconry Guidebook and Rule Orson 720 as presented.
Second, Bill, second. All in favor?
Aye.
To the vote? Okay, Stacy. Certification review.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll make this quick.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Stacy Coons. I chair the certification review committee. We recently had a request for a Capuchin monkey from a Derek Blankmeyer. It's a little bit different in this situation. Helping Hands, which is a nonprofit organization out of Boston, is the one actually making the request. The COR would actually, if approved by you guys, would be for a personal possession for Mr. Blankmeyer. He will actually not ever retain ownership of the monkey. That will stay with Helping Hands. You write in your packet that he's had a spinal cord injury. This monkey has been trained to come out to help with life functions, keeping things up, getting things, cutting lights off, holding lids, that kind of thing. In talking to Helping Hands, this is what they do. They do provide service monkeys. Now, a service monkey is not technically recognized, so it would just be the personal possession for him. Their director is available by phone if you guys have any further questions for them. I did send them the stipulations that the committee had come up with. You had those in your packet. There was just the three, that Helping Hands retains full ownership of the monkey, that the monkey must have a tuberculosis test within 60 days of entering our state, and that they would sign the hold harmless indemnification agreement. They are in agreement with all of that. Helping Hands actually will hold insurance and be liable for the monkey. It does not go out in public, it's not a pet, it doesn't travel with him, it can't leave his home. A member from Helping Hands will actually fly out with the monkey and will spend a couple of weeks in the home making sure that their attachment is a good one and training them on how to use it. If they feel for any reason that it's not a good match for him, they will remove the monkey at that time and try something different. They do have an extensive application process in order to even be considered for one of those monkeys. So Derek Blankmeyer has already gone through that process with them to make sure he's a good fit for this, and they feel confident with that. So the committee's recommendation is to allow the personal possession of a Capuchin monkey from Mr. Blankmeyer.
Thank you. Any questions from the board? Bill?
Is it required to have a veterinary certificate from the Department of Ag?
To transport it into Utah, yes, and they will meet that requirement as well.
Anything else? This is something they call the reaction.
No, it doesn't go, it's just board action.
No discussion, let's have a motion.
So moved. Do you want any more detail on that?
Kevin, you're wasting my time. Could you speed this up?
Say what? You want me to make the motion second of both?
I'd love it.
I can't do that. I'll second it for trouble.
Okay, motion moved. Kevin, a second. Is all in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you.
What do you have now? Just other business. Can you bring us a walk-in sale? Can you do that?
Stacy, clarification on the cutthroat trout and corn creek.
It doesn't come before the board.
There's not.
Same with the hunting on animal violence.
That was a motion that showed up at the Northern Region RAC, and they made a motion for the board to consider it. I believe Bill Fenimore is going to speak to that under other business.
Hey, Bill, do you want to give us that?
Yeah. At the Northern Region RAC meeting, there was a discussion under other business. The representative from the birding community, the Watchful Wildlife folks in the Northern Region, discussed kind of a social conflict issue that's come about where duck hunters in late winter are hunting along Antelope Island Causeway in a couple spots where there's a few patches of open water, which are a big magnet for the birds, obviously. And in winter, we get a variety of very rare birds that show up in Utah, which are a big magnet for birders that want to come out and watch and see them and enjoy them and so forth. For an example, this winter we've had all three scoters. We've had three harlequin ducks, which is extremely rare for us, and some long-tailed ducks. So these are really big attractions for the birding community. It's a big economic impact for Davis County, getting those folks in and out. And then when they get out there on occasion, there's a duck hunter set up in a layout boat with his decoys, and as the birds are coming in, he's blasting them, and it's, you know, it's like, ah! So anyway, in the presentation at the Northern RAC, after the discussion and explanation of what was going on, the Northern Rec made a motion that was passed 11-1 to request that the Wildlife Board ask the division if they would study the matter, take it under advisement, study it, and then make any recommendations that they saw that might be suitable for the waterfowl proclamation this coming August. So I, you know, make that request that we either put on the action log, or it doesn't need to be an action log item, maybe we just make a request to the division through Justin Dolling, maybe form a committee of some of these interest groups on all sides. The Utah Waterfowl Association and the Utah Wildlife Cooperative, I've talked to both of them. They both said they support this recommendation of creating sort of a buffer zone, maybe like a 100-yard buffer zone, something like that along the causeway, where they wouldn't have hunting taking place. And at the Waterfowl Committee meeting that Justin was setting up, we talked about this issue as well, and it had favorable support from the hunting groups represented there as well. So I think it would be a good thing for the committee to be formed and review it, and then come forward with any recommendations that they think might be appropriate when the Waterfowl Proclamation comes up in August.
Ernie, you had a comment on that?
Yeah, the only thing I had to what Bill has said is, as presented, there's nothing of an anti-hunting issue in this. It's a question of social conflict, it's a question of economics in terms of getting the birders in from out of state, contributing to the economy. And I do anticipate, based on multiple comments, that there'll be other waterfowl and sportsman groups, and we'll be supporting this thing as it moves forward.
So I have a question for Justin. Will there not be a recommendation on this out of the waterfowl committee? I'm hoping they can handle this and we don't need to put a separate committee together.
Yeah, actually, Jim, our waterfowl committee is winding down, and that was really beyond the scope of our charter. So this came up at the last minute. My thought was that it could possibly be discussed at our next waterfowl recommendation cycle, and that would give us plenty of time to look at
exploring the issue and then looking at the different sides of that issue.
So let the region handle it as a regional issue and bring the parties in as necessary to discuss.
Probably ought to be a combined effort between the region and Salt Lake, the new water fountain program coordinator. In my mind, needs to be involved in, this, in those discussions.
So do we need to put that on the action log?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. As long as the division's willing to take a look at it, as Justin recommended, I think that'd be fine.
You used the term long tail duck.
Yeah, it used to be old school.
Yeah, I like the old school. I like the old school.
I think I noticed in the board packet, the copy that you gave me, those tabled items, list of tables, they deal with those because one of them was taking turkeys with falcons.
What do you mean, what they deal with?
Will that come up today? And, so that's just for record.
Let me make a motion that put this item on the action log for the division. For the division to study and have and to make recommendations.
Okay, motion being made to study the Antelope Mile and Duck Hunting on the Causeway. Have a second?
Second.
Okay, we'll put that on the action log then. Ernie, do you want to?
Yeah.
Will you give us a lawful report?
It was a good meeting. Attendance was down, which is no surprise given the economy at 19 commissioners from 11 states. I'd like to give credit to Cindy. She and I worked on a massive change to the commissioners committee webpage for Laughlin. Put a lot of new procedures that was adopted. Parts of it are already up on the website. Other pages yet to be posted, but it's coming. Be a big improvement. Also, the Commissioners Committee in the last year and a half has been working to spur WAFWA and OFWA, the national organization, to get started on trying to resolve some of the conflicts and confusions between the states and the federal agencies on authorities over wildlife, most commonly that on federal lands within the state. That got adopted finally. It's on its way to OFWA. Our surrounding state directors and commissioners fended off a delaying action tactic out of Alaska and kept the thing on track, and it's moving. And I think that will benefit us down the road. Next big effort for the Commissioners Committee is going to be a conservation leadership subcommittee and topic. I've attached a handout that shows you what the scope of that is. Each state is going to be asked to provide a long-term commissioner to support that effort. I can do it for a bit, but we'll need to find somebody, and I'll pursue seeing if I can find a volunteer who's interested in attending the WAFWA meetings to support that. Alternative funding was a recurring topic probably for the third time in 10 years, as requested by the commissioners. Everybody knows that we need to expand our citizen base and our funding base. And I put two handouts in this package. Take a look. One of them is pretty darn good. It's a review of what's been tried, worked, and didn't work. Had a good topic on predator-prey relationships. Idaho Assistant Director Jim Lunsworth gave a great presentation. I really liked one of his points that he made in it. It was very powerful for me. He said that our management, predator management concepts and our game management concepts had largely been developed in the first half of the 20th century. And that was a period when the western U.S. was devoid of predators and sheep were everywhere. So we had all this fine set of rules that worked great in the 50s and 60s and so forth. But then by the 70s, things were changing and it became obvious that wildlife professionals also needed to be concerned about roads, fragmentation, hunting and some other things as technologies and populations change. And then a
they said in the 1990s, Wolves entered the fray and changed the whole equation again. Because we had learned that bears and coyotes and lions can have a bit of an impact on ungulates in particular. If you add wolves into the picture, Idaho and Montana and Wyoming have learned that the whole equation has greatly changed. And the whole structure of the discussion has changed. A copy of all the state inputs on that topic is also attached in this package. Wyoming commissioner said they are very pleased with their state statute that they put out on shed antler hunting, and which is currently just the western part of Wyoming, and they're thinking about expanding it to statewide. Mike Fowkes is working on that one for other reasons too, but he's got it. New outdoor roadmap program. It's got a new approach on hunter recruitment that's pretty interesting. It basically pays individuals to become a hunter $50 at a time as they progress through the steps. It looks like it would be compatible with all those other programs we're using. Idaho's going to have an outdoor summit in August. It's a novel recruitment and outreach idea where they're going to try and get to the whole middle group of citizens, not the active hunters, not the ones that are anti-hunting, but all the rest in the middle, and bring them in for a huge event in Boise, and everybody's welcome. Personally, I'd like to see Dean Mitchell there just to see what he gets out of it. That's the commission's decision, obviously. Last item. The benefit of the new commissioners, Nevada's been going through a huge upheaval in the last 4 years. They got to the point where two of the RACs in Nevada were suing their wildlife board in court, and where the wildlife board was doing things completely different than what the RACs were recommending. Where the wildlife board, where the director informed the wildlife board that he no longer had the funding to provide minutes or other administrative support, wished the Fish and Game Commission good luck, and where the Fish and Game Commission actively sought to get the director fired. Eventually, at one point, the director got relieved. Then, a few months later, a new governor came in. He reappointed the fire director as the interim director, which didn't take commission approval, and then shortly thereafter fired over half the board, and new board members came in. During this whole time, the old board decided that they had to have a bear hunt, a black bear hunt. So they set up, and I would say rammed a bear hunt down system, and they had a bear hunt last year. The commissioners that were at the meeting said that they were in the middle of the biggest disaster they could have ever conceived of, in that they had created more anti-hunters and more fervent anti-hunters and more attention, microscopic attention, to everything their advisory councils and their board was doing than anything that they could have ever conceived of. So that virtually everything they are doing is under a microscope and is getting criticized by a huge portion of people before they even listen to it. So they were looking for ideas on damage control. So I just offer that out. Disregard public at your own risk, I guess, was the message that they were trying to send. But it'd be interesting to get a couple of those guys over just to sit and discuss what they're going through. Okay, that's it.
Okay. One other thing I have. Didn't we talk about a work session in March, Stacey?
Yes. You actually threw the date of March 15th out. That happens to be a date that Ednice and Alan are both traveling back from a conference.
Okay.
So we would like to move it to the 16th, which is a Friday, so not my favorite. But does that work for everybody to do a March 16th work session.
We get overtime paid for Saturday or for Friday.
I do. You get the same $90.
Wait, my first $90. Huh. The same.
What day would that be?
Friday, 16th? March 16th.
Day before St. Patty's Day, you're going to have the appropriate.
I will be available. Just saying.
Do you want me to answer that?
You want me to answer for you?
Or we can look for a different, I know you're trying to look for after the legislative session, but before the RAC proposals needed to be finalized, so.
Someone was going to hold that amendment.
See, you were talking about. Can we do it the week following?
Sometime between the 19th and the 23rd.
There's all kinds of meetings that week.
And the proposals actually have to be finalized by the 27th of March, so that's the other end of the deadline we're working against.
Just a second, I'm looking up on this.
You guys make the schedule. Tell us when to show up.
Can you guys swing out a weekend day with the comp time?
On St. Patrick's Day?
Then we can really celebrate.
Just another Saturday.
You know, you're backing me in a corner, because if there's snow, I won't be here. But
quite well taken. We'll avoid Saturday.
So you're telling me to do the snow dance, is that what you're saying?
I've been dancing, it's not working.
I hear you.
What about March 9th? Legislature's over.
That's a Friday as well.
March 9th works for me. Works for me.
I'm not dead sure it works for me, but if it's any better.
How about the 8th?
8th?
8th works.
March 8th?
That's the last day of the legislature, right? Like what you're getting.
And I'm not sure when Anise leaves. Do you know Jim?
I don't know where he's
going. I said Canada for him and Alan.
I was not aware of either one.
And I don't know that it's all the way approved. Anyway, there's some kind of species conference that week that he'll be traveling back on Thursday the 15th.
We've got two conflicts. One is the DWR employees, tenants, and one is John's work on weekends.
Well, if you're not going to get any sympathy out of Stacy from my account, so hopefully we can hold it. Either I can be there.
What's wrong with the last week of March?
We got to have the brown bags the 27th of March. And it was my understanding that the board wanted to hear those proposals prior.
But it's not an action session. Right, it's just a working.
Right, but what they're going to be talking about is the proposals that have to be finalized by the 27th.
Yeah, but they won't be voted.
No, but if we met after the 27th and they didn't care for what the proposal was, we wouldn't have time to change it.
But, yeah.
You're uncovering a strategy here.
So. I mean,
it's pretty tight.
I'm out of dates for you.
Well,
the 15th's not a choice.
Let's just throw it out on the 16th and John. We're just going to keep you abreast of it.
So 16th?
That all right with everybody? I mean, we're not going to have
16th's okay for me.
I'm not sure if I'll be here or not. I'm still waiting for a schedule on a meeting, so.
Better have you here, haven't
we? Not necessarily. Mr. Chairman, I'll just go over the, when we get the materials, I'll just go over with any concerns or anything.
You said that Alan and Kevin are not available on the 15th.
Alan Alan and Anise.
And Anise. Perhaps one of them could come back a day early.
I couldn't make that answer for them.
All I'd say is I'm asking.
Call him or something, see what the deal is.
One of them could come back a day early, we're set. Either. Summer Walkway is in the Big Island in Hawaii.
That's the idea.
Is going as advertised and recognizing the difficulties that people might have getting to Hawaii, they offered to send letters from the governor of Hawaii to any and all invitations. Explaining how important it was.
Invitations, but that's right too.
That's a lot of good invitations. So what did you decide, Stacy?
Well, we're just gonna.
How about we work on a date? What are our options?
I heard the 8th, 9th, or 16th.
Eighth is not an option.
So the 9th or the 16th?
The 15th.
I think the majority of the board, except for John, has no problem meeting any one of those surgeries.
What's a day? What's a, can you do the 15th?
The third, that's a Thursday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can do that.
Everybody good on?
But you don't know if Anise.
We don't know if this other.
I don't know if Anise would be back yet.
So you got it.
And maybe we have someone fill in if he's not here.
Well, why don't we discuss the 15th or 16th?
Okay.
And are you planning one, still an afternoon meeting or morning? Do you care? It's not in conjunction with the board meeting, so I didn't know when you wanted to come.
What afternoon is what I'm thinking. As far as the board,
doesn't matter.
Okay. Okay.
We'll just leave it at that.
Yep, I'll send you an email.
With that, I believe we're done.
I believe so.
Thank you all. Do I have a motion with your?
A move.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We're out.